Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Alan Buttle Radio Show on Eurofolk Radio. Thank you very much to Eurofolk for giving me this opportunity to continue talking with you, and thanks a lot to the people at Grism, grism.blogspot.com, which continues to help me and put my work on their page, and it's a fantastic source for finding the latest information from people within our broad movement, and I would very much recommend going and seeing what you can find there. So this week I would like to talk a bit about Julian Assange, and I know I talked about him last week, but I think there's lots more details to uncover, and I think there's also it's a very, very serious matter, this WikiLeaks Julian Assange story, and I think it's very important we get to the bottom of it, because I think that there is he has a very, very big part to play going forward, and he is almost in a unique position in the world as a public figure, and I shall explain a bit about what I mean by that later, having presented you with some of the information that I intend to. So in terms of the history of Julian Assange and this kind of thing. Basically, let's start from the start. Julian Assange was born as he wasn't born actually. Julian Assange, he was born Julian Hawkins after his mother, Christine Hawkins. His mother and her and Julian Assange's supposed biological father split up before Assange was even born, and he actually took the name Assange off the subsequent partner of his mother, a guy called Richard Assange, and apparently they were involved in that relationship with Richard Assange didn't last very long either, and she ended up with a guy called Leif Meynell. That's L-E-I-F, Meynell. Strange name. But but he was involved in this cult called The Family with a woman called Anne Hamilton Byrne. Now, at this time, the story goes that the Christine Hawkins and her son Julian and this Leif Meynell, they were managing a moving theatre company, and they'd be travelling around a lot, and there's very, very few details as to the sort of the whereabouts of this group sort of during Julian Assange's early years, but we do know that Leif Meynell was involved in this organisation called The Family. So I'd just like to talk a bit about The Family and how connections regarding The Family are kind of similar and perhaps explanatory in the sense of trying to understand Julian Assange today. So The Family was a sort of Australian New Age cult which was formed in the mid-1960s under the leadership of a woman called Anne Hamilton Byrne, who was in fact born Evelyn Edwards, but she changed her name to Anne Hamilton and then married a guy called Bill Byrne, and an English guy. So she became Anne Hamilton Byrne. She hyphenated the name that she gave herself with her husband's name. So and her husband, funnily enough, also took on the name Hamilton Byrne as well. He no longer remained Bill Byrne, but Bill Hamilton Byrne. And she created this sort of cult around herself, because her philosophy was that she was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ, and that and basically she was similar to people like Buddha and Krishna and Jesus, and that she she was of a higher realm, if you like. So it was around 1964 that she became connected with Rainer Johnson, who was a doctor in the sort of in Australia, and he had gone there from England. He's actually English, but he moved to Australia in 1964, where he connected with with Anne Hamilton Byrne, and they helped found the they basically started off having discussion meetings about philosophy and religion and this kind of thing, and they eventually bought a property with the help of Rainer Johnson, which they named it's very difficult to say, Santiniketan Park, and that was in 1968, and they constructed a meeting hall there where they continued to conduct meetings and do yoga classes and things like this, because she was a yoga teacher. But they basically they started off kind of experimenting on patients with things like LSD, things like various psychiatric drugs like flufenazine, diazepam, haloperidol, and chlorpromazine, and a whole host of different sort of psychiatric drugs, and they were conducting even things like lobotomies and things like this on people as supposed treatment for mental disorders. And this was in a place called New Haven Hospital, which was just outside of Melbourne, and so they were sort of acquiring young people through the increasing following that the kind of middle to upper echelons of the society there, they were becoming there was a greater uptake of indoctrination to this cult. People would actually give their children to Anne Hamilton Byrne, who would pretend to be the child's biological mother, and then they would be subjected to all sorts of sort of beatings and then sort of an initiation at the age of about 14 into LSD and this kind of thing. And they actually managed to adopt lots and lots of children through their connections with various lawyers and judges and this kind of thing, because they were connected right into the very top of Australian society. So there was a lawyer, for example, a guy called Peter Kibbe, who was actually helping with the paperwork and things like this, trying, you know, and basically forging adoption or falsifying adoption papers and things like this, so that Anne Hamilton Byrne was their biological mother and this kind of thing, or however it worked. But there was basically an ongoing process of actually collecting children to be brought into this quote unquote family, and for the purposes of basically experimentation and this kind of thing. So they eventually at the point of when they had the most children, they had about 28 children there. And they would, yeah, as I say, when they would reach adolescence, sort of maybe 13, 14, this kind of age, they would undergo an initiation involving LSD. And this would actually sometimes be injected into them, amazingly. And they would be left in a dark room on their own, and they would be visited by Anne Hamilton Byrne or some of the other psychiatrists from the group. And this kind of organisation, this cult, if you like, although it was a cult, but it was there were lots of medical professionals involved, and there were they were conducting actual experiments and administering drugs and procedures to these people. So it wasn't a cult in the normal sense of you might come together and perform certain rituals together or whatever. No, there was actually you know, they were actually performing things to people under the guise of help and under the guise of sort of medicine sort of thing. And as I say, these would even include things like lobotomies, you know, amazingly enough. So yeah, as I say, there were lots of actual doctors involved in this, and a few of them include Dr. Rayner Johnson, Dr. Eric Cunningham Dax, Dr. Howard Whittaker, and Dr. John Mackay. And these are all, you know, like these are all actual doctors involved in this cult organization, with, you know, that were bringing people into this sort of this experimentation organization under the guise of a religious ideology, that this Anne Hamilton Byrne was in fact Jesus Christ come back to earth. I think one interesting connection to make is the guy Rayner Johnson, who was basically the co-founder of this group. And although Anne Hamilton Byrne was the figurehead of it, being the sort of center point of the ideology, Rayner Johnson actually had great connections, and he was involved in an organization called the Society for Psychical Research in London. That was before he moved to Australia. And the Society for Psychical Research is actually a very old society, amazingly. It was founded in 1882, and the first several you'll know some of the presidents of this society because they're extremely well known. Like, for example, Arthur Balfour. Now, Arthur Balfour, the foreign minister at the time when the Balfour Declaration was made, and who later became Prime Minister of the UK. So he was actually the president of this organisation in 1893, obviously about 20 years before the signing of the Balfour Declaration, or 24 years. But there are other people who were very connected to them, like the husband of Arthur Balfour's sister, a guy called Henry Sidgwick. He was involved, and he actually was one of the co-founders of this organization, and he was a member of the secret Cambridge Apostle Society, and actually Arthur Balfour's brother ended up as president of this society as well. But I encourage you to have a look at down the list. I'm sure some of these names will jump out to you, you know, stronger than they jump out to me, because I only know of certain people and things, but many people have their own research and will be interested in other things. But these are clearly, look, having a, you know, rudimentary look through these characters who have run this organization, they are very, very well connected. It's not some hocus pocus sort of like fringe organization, you know, set up by quacks and set up by, you know, people that are really, really out there sort of thing on the fringes. No, these are really, really prominent people involved in this organization, and it's called the Society for Psychical Research. And as I say, this guy Rayner Johnson came from was connected with that organization while he was in the UK before coming to Australia to be involved in this family cult. And you know, obviously this was this cult was in operation for several decades, you know. It was going basically all through the 60s and 70s, and it wasn't until basically the late 80s when children were actually taken away from the property, which was in 1987 when the police raided them and children were taken away. And actually one of the people that was subjected to abuse in this cult, a woman called Sarah Hamilton Byrne, who also later became, what was her, she changed her name, but sort of after the release of her book, but I can't remember what she actually changed her name to, Sarah something, but Sarah Hamilton Byrne actually wrote a book called Unseen, Unheard, Unknown, and this was released in 1995, and it discloses a lot of the information about this this cult and sort of published her experiences of actually being subjected to the abuse of this cult. So you know, so this you know, so it's an absolutely awful institution, but this is something that the sort of stepfather of Julian Assange was closely involved with, and as I say, it connects to very, very high ranking people, including a guy called Lord Richard Casey. Now, Richard Casey is a very, very well connected person. Now, Richard Casey was the former Governor General of Australia from 1965 to 1969. And he was the minister responsible for the Australian Secret Intelligence Service. Amazingly enough, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service headquarters is actually called R.G. Casey House. So actually their own intelligence service headquarters is named after him. And this was a guy that was intimately involved with the family cult and with Anne Hamilton Byrne, and he was basically you know, employed by Winston Churchill. He was connected right to the very, very top of British and Australian society, and yeah, he was extremely important as a character, and and yeah, so I think so that connection needs to be sort of further scrutinized, but yeah, he seemed to be involved in this cult too, as well as a guy called Ronald Conway, who was a psychiatrist or a psychologist who basically encouraged sort of sexual contact between the psychologist, as he was, and the patients. So he would, you know, he would basically molest his patients and encourage them to repay the dubious courtesy. But yeah, he was connected to people at the very top of the Catholic Church in Australia, for example, and yeah, so I mean, the reason this cult was able to go on so long was clearly because they had protection throughout the higher echelons of society, and you only get that by being connected through the Freemasons or through sort of organized Jewish sort of secret organizations, I would suggest. So, you know, when we combine our understanding of this family cult, and obviously things like, you know, they managed to get themselves LSD for the purposes of these experiments and of sort of psychologically, you know, experimenting on these children and young adults at this center. Where did they get the LSD from? Well, there's claims that it came from Sandoz, which was also providing LSD for the CIA and their MK Ultra sort of projects and things like this. So, and obviously Albert Hoffman was actually working for Sandoz, and that's where he invented it or he discovered it, you know, and. So yeah, this can go right back to the pharmaceuticals and the very people involved in the creation of this this drug. So yeah, and another interesting, I think extremely interesting snippet of information is that in the 1980s, the Australian police estimated that Anne Hamilton Byrne's fortune could be as much as $50 million. $50 million. How did she make all that money? She wasn't selling anything. She wasn't producing anything. You know, she was involved in a cult that abused children. So where did she get all that money from? And what was it for? So, you know, what financial value to very rich people did this cult organization have? So we can only speculate on that, but you know, I believe it completely fits into the idea of the whole thing being actually an intelligence operation, and that sort of the understanding the effect of drugs and other sort of abuse on the minds of young people does have a great value to the people that want to control society. And I suggest that huge fortune was as a result of the work, or the value of the work to the kind of people that wants to, you know, but basically understand the effects of these weapons on young people. So you know, so $50 million, you know, that's an incredible amount of money for someone, and bearing in mind this was back in the 1980s as well, and $50 million then is probably worth $500 million now. So there you go. So yeah, that is a little bit of the story of the family, which was the sort of foundation of Julian Assange's childhood, if you like. And there are photos of people in the family that sort of and it suggested that Julian Assange is pictured with them, with the sort of trademark dyed blonde hair that people were given in the family. People that sort of didn't have this copper coloured hair and things had their hair dyed blonde in the family. It's another strange thing, kind of reminiscent of an old film which I can't remember the name of right now, but yeah, very very strange organisation, and one that requires in further investigation, and I've tried to piece together you know, like, because it says literally, like, you know, dozens and dozens of people from the top society were involved in this cult, and what these people were actually doing. I mean, whether or not they would pay for access to these vulnerable children or whatever, I don't know. But it's hard to find out the names of these people that were participants in it, and so obviously that is being kept well under wraps. But you know, there's plenty more digging I can do into it, but yeah, I think we get the general idea as to what this organization was about. I'm sure I don't need to convince any of you that giving 14-year-olds LSD and locking them in a dark room as some sort of initiation to a cult is anything other than pure evil. So yeah, moving on from that, I mean, Julian Assange, there's very little known about his sort of adult life, to be honest. Like, there's been speculation as to, you know, he was involved in hacking and all this kind of thing, and he never really was very, you know, he got in some legal trouble, but he was never, you know, in very serious legal trouble, and he was always, you know, he always pretty much got away with it, and yeah, but we don't really know how he earned his money, how he paid his way throughout his most of his adult life, and yeah, you know, so we can only, you know, or at least it wasn't easy for me to find out you know, just exactly what he was up to all that time. But upon the creation of WikiLeaks, you know, he obviously has become an absolute international superstar. And this was all thanks to the support he's had from the establishment. Now, WikiLeaks is basically, you know, the reason everyone heard about it was because it was massively publicised in the mainstream media. You know, he won an award for let me just find the information. He's won numerous awards from very seriously mainstream sources. Like, for example, The Economist gave him a New Media Award in 2008. Amnesty International gave him a UK Media Award in 2009. Time Person of the Year in 2010. Le Monde Reader's Choice Award for Person of the Year, 2010. Sydney Peace Foundation Gold Medal, 2011. You know, it just goes on and on and on. He's very well awarded. And you know, they don't hand out these awards for nothing. You know, we don't really need to investigate, you know, organisations like The Economist, do we? We know who they're working for. We know what interests they represent. The same as Amnesty International, you know, which was set up by a blood relative of the Rothschild family. You know, these were the kind of organisations that were, you know, projecting him into superstardom. And it's really, really worked. And I think the reason it's worked so well is because there's so few people in the mainstream that are sort of given a kind of persona that he has given, like as a champion for transparency and a champion for accountability of the state and the belief that there should be no state secrets. There should be the exposing of secrets, especially secrets that expose crimes. So yeah, I mean, there you go. I mean, I just noticed this thing while I'm going through these web pages that I've sort of set up in order to provide this narrative. Let me just read this bit, and it will interest all of my audience, I'm sure, who are very well aware of the Jewish element behind the movements in our world. It says, and this is coming from Wikipedia, not WikiLeaks, on 1st of March 2011, Assange released a statement in which he said, "Hislop has distorted, invented, or misremembered almost every significant claim and phrase. In particular, Jewish conspiracy is completely false, in spirit and in word. It is serious and upsetting. We treasure our strong Jewish support and staff, just as we treasure the support from pan-Arab democracy activists and others who share our hope for a just world." Well, if there isn't a strong statement, a strong quote that we can give from Julian Assange exposing who he really is, then I suggest that is as good as we're going to find. "We treasure our strong Jewish support and staff." Yes, and there is a strong Jewish presence within WikiLeaks as well. People are sort of fooled into thinking that WikiLeaks is simply Julian Assange and his laptop. It's not the case. They do have a serious following all over the world, and they publish from numerous locations, and they have been publishing while Assange has supposedly been in the Ecuadorian embassy. But let me just take you through some other details that might also illuminate what WikiLeaks is really about. And I think, you know, I have sort of been slightly you know, like, I don't know what the right word is. I don't want to be too harsh, but I've been slightly disappointed to hear so many people, you know, in our sort of movement, just jumping to defend Julian Assange because of the persona that he's supposed to represent of, you know, of transparency and all this kind of thing that I mentioned, without taking a single second to look at the kind of organisations that WikiLeaks are very explicitly connected to, and the individuals that WikiLeaks are explicitly connected to. So let me just show you, for example, the people that WikiLeaks actually list on their website as partners. Now, I think, you know, and so we're not getting this from any third-hand person. We're not, it's not speculation, it's nothing like that. This is coming directly from the WikiLeaks website. And who they're partners of. Who are they partners of? Associated Press, who are responsible for pretty much half of the news media articles that come out globally, pretty much. They are connected, they list their partners as, you know, French mainstream media publication Le Monde. Like they, you know, Russia Today is one of them. The Guardian from the UK, the Guardian of all newspapers, is listed as a partner. The Telegraph, the other side of the British media establishment, the right to Guardian's left, the Telegraph is listed as a partner. The New York Times, or the New York Times, as you might say. The Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, you know, Russia Today. I don't know if I mentioned that. Maybe I did already. But yeah, you can have a look. If you go to WikiLeaks.org, you'll find partners as one of the tabs at the top. Just click that, and you'll see all of these organisations that they call partners. And you know, do we really need to look beyond that? So any illusion that Assange and WikiLeaks were somehow anti-establishment, somehow interested in the truth, and and exposing true criminality, they would not be partnered with Associated Press. They would not be partnered with The Guardian. They would not be partnered with The New York Times or The Daily Telegraph or The Washington Post or Russia Today. It's just impossible, absolutely impossible. So yeah, I mean, I suggest that page should be enough for anyone to understand what WikiLeaks is really about. And at the same time, all these other organisations, because the ones I've just listed are but a few of the organisations that WikiLeaks declares as their partners, and the subtitle is co-publishers, research partners and funders. So basically collaborators in one way or another, and it lists all these organizations, and I suggest it exposes all of these organizations as particular aspects of the establishment all pushing the same objective, albeit often in different ways, like for example The Guardian and The Telegraph. You know, they're not really against each other, you know, just like Theresa May is not really against Jeremy Corbyn. They're working to the same objectives. And I found another thing that was very interesting on the on the WikiLeaks website, and I really wish people would just do some really, really basic research before coming out in support of people like Assange. So here we go. Let's have a look at this. If you go to wikileaks.org/press.html, we find a whole host of contacts which you can use to as quote unquote reliable people, well informed people, and the it says the commentators listed and their contact details are publicly available. These commentators do not represent WikiLeaks. They are listed because they are knowledgeable about the topics. So, these knowledgeable people that they decide to list, well, who are they? There's people connected to the United Nations, there's people part of the Jewish mainstream establishment, there's a guy called Glenn Greenwald, who is a gay Jewish lawyer who is involved in WikiLeaks. We have Jewish guy called Yochai Benkler of Harvard Law School, who has defended WikiLeaks. We have people like John Pilger, who is the Russia Today documentary filmmaker, which is and who is extremely well connected to Julian Assange personally. We have, and this one really, really takes the biscuit, Alan Dershowitz. Now, if anyone knows Alan Dershowitz, you'll also know that he is one of Jeffrey Epstein's greatest friends. Jeffrey Epstein, that billionaire paedophile who has all the contacts of the establishment and provides or helps provide young children for their enjoyment. And he boasts in his little black book the contact details of people like Bill Clinton, like Donald Trump, like Alan Dershowitz himself, and all sorts of people. You can have a look at this document for yourself. It's been partially redacted, but you can see who he lists as contacts in there. And Alan Dershowitz has for a very long time been extremely close to Jeffrey Epstein, as Jeffrey Epstein is also well connected to the British royal family and countless other people, and he's also been a major, major donor to Harvard University. You know, we're talking a guy who has made billions out of alleged child trafficking and child sexual abuse. He is donating, a lot of those billions specifically to scientific research projects in Harvard. You know, what does that tell you? But Alan Dershowitz, who also is from Harvard University, he's one of the major legal sort of allies, I suppose, of Julian Assange. Can you believe it? This awful, awful human being. We have just a huge array of people who are completely, completely corrupt. We can just look at the kind of people that, and obviously I've taken a massive jump here from obviously the family and the history of the family, and now I'm talking about the direct current day connections to WikiLeaks. But I think it's helping to build a whole picture of what where Assange has come from and what and it might serve to explain the connections that he has today. So let's have a look for a second at the lawyers that have supported Julian Assange and have been representing Assange. And bearing in mind, there is no more mainstream establishment organization, or I say organization, I don't mean organization really, I mean industry, than the legal profession, basically. It is completely Jewish controlled, completely Jewish dominated, and these people are reliant on the membership to the bar, how they say, in order to continue practicing law. So they're not going to be representing someone that basically poses a threat to the establishment. Not these massive name solicitors. So I'd just like to go into a few of them, and there are quite a few of people that are really on Assange's side. And let's start with a guy called Mark Stevens. So Mark Stevens, he's been a prominent supporter and advocate for Julian Assange. He represented him in 2010, and he defended him against the possible extradition to Sweden, and obviously, for the purposes of defending himself against the two rape accusations in Sweden, which I want to mention a bit as well a bit later. But Mark Stevens has actually been a lawyer that has represented the Rothschild family very directly. Let me just find the information on this one for you. So yeah, Mark Stevens was the representative of the law firm Finers Stevens Innocent, and he was the legal advisor to the Rothschild Waddesdon Trust, which is basically concerned with the maintenance, improvement and payment of certain of the outgoings in respect of Waddesdon Manor, which is Rothschild's most prestigious property in the UK, and it's in Buckinghamshire. So basically he has been directly representing Rothschild interests. And the Waddesdon Trust, who employed Finers Stevens Innocent and obviously Mark Stevens, who is named in that firm, it boasts Lord Jacob Rothschild, Lady Rothschild and Beth Matilda Rothschild as their trustees. So he's been directly employed by the Rothschild family, and now he's representing Julian Assange, and this guy has also represented James Hewitt and I don't know, you should have a look for yourself at this guy. There's a very long sort of Wikipedia biography of him, which obviously goes into the superficial details as to who he has been representing and this kind of thing, you know, because like the newspapers are very, very reliable at giving you the correct football results, the Wikipedia is very reliable at giving you the basic skeleton information surrounding certain individuals, So I suggest we can use it in that way. And I'm certainly no advocate of using Wikipedia to find out what happened at certain events. You know, like the Wikipedia page on 9/11, for example, is an absolute joke, as you would imagine. But it is a useful tool when it comes to investigating certain people and their connections, and it can actually point you in very useful directions, as long as you don't take it as the as a pure source, if you like, pure source of information. So he is one of the very big name solicitors that has represented Julian Assange, and another is a woman called Helena Kennedy, who appeared on this documentary about WikiLeaks as well quite recently, a documentary called Risk, I believe, and she. Well, I mean, I was amazed at the list of her lists of membership of organisations for a start. I couldn't believe the amount of organisations that she is involved in at the highest levels. Helena Kennedy, her name is. She's the Chairwoman of Justice, which is the judicial organisation. I'll tell you what, I'll just read out a handful of them, and there must be 30 or 40 organisations that she is the chair or the patron of or the president of. Absolutely amazing, and she's clearly very, very important and very crucial to this current ruling establishment. So she's chair of the British Council, she's chair of the Human Genetics Commission, Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University, Chancellor of Oxford Brookes University, President of the Medical Aid for Palestinians, Patron of the Burma Campaign UK. She's a member of the Board of the British Museum. She's a member of the World Bank Institute's External Advisory Council. She's the patron of Liberty. She's a patron of Unlock, the National Association of Ex-Offenders. She's the chair of the Royal Colleges of Pathologists and of Paediatrics Inquiry into Sudden Infant Death. She's a member of the Foreign Policy Center's Advisory Council. She's got this huge list of organizations that she is or has been involved in. And yeah, you know, she's clearly very, very part of this elite, this current elite. And she is now one of the main lawyers representing Julian Assange. And again, it just wouldn't happen. You wouldn't get people like this representing Julian Assange if he was actually a threat to the establishment. No, he's not a threat to the establishment one little bit. And there are others that are, you know, that you can look up as well, including Jennifer Robinson, Gareth Pierce. And Gareth Pierce, you'd thought would be a man, but it's not, it's a woman. I've never heard of the name Gareth for a woman before, but there are women called Gareth, apparently, and Gareth Pierce is one of them, and she's a very major barrister, also working for Julian Assange at the moment. We have a guy called Jeffrey Robertson, and a recently deceased lawyer called Michael Ratner, who also represents Julian Assange. But we have a whole array of very, very elite lawyers who have been representing Julian Assange. So there you go. I just wanted to get on to the point about his potential extradition to Sweden to face rape charges, and also, actually, in fact, the unique position he has in public life, because I would suggest for most people in the mass media, if you were accused of rape by two separate women, it would almost be the end of your career. It would be the end of your, the end of the public's liking of you, the end of sort of your, it would sort of make a permanent smudge on your character, and one that would be practically impossible to shake off, I would suggest. And I think, you know, there are many examples of this where such accusations have been the wrecking of careers and of sort of their image in the public. But with Assange, it's, you know, he's an absolute phenomenon in the sense that the accusation of rape that was made against him, the double accusation of rape, has actually done his global popularity no harm whatsoever. It's absolutely amazing. It's like he's completely untouchable, which he actually uses that expression himself. I am now untouchable in this country, he says. That because he is presented as such a threat to the establishment, sort of a very significant percentage of the general public will just not believe anything that he is accused of, no matter what it is, no matter how disgusting the crime that he's being accused of. They just simply will not believe it because of the character which they believe, which is that he is a threat to the establishment by the way that he believes in exposing secrets, basically. And I'm not even saying that these accusations are true. As far as I can see, it could well be the case that Assange, that even the rape accusations were a way of testing the public's reaction to them, and testing Assange's popularity, and sort of seeing how, you know, how he would maintain his popularity regardless of these accusations. I've got no reason to think that these accusations are either true or false. I think they're likely false, to be honest, because I think that that there's nothing real about this whole thing, and they don't like to keep anything real. They don't like to have anything real going on with regard to Assange, you know, because if they can just make it completely fictional, then I think that's to their vague advantage. But I think that you know, that Assange could and likely is involved in all sorts of other, you know, horrible criminality. I thought it was absolutely fascinating the way that he is an absolute global superstar, completely manufactured by the mainstream media, and it really it boggles the mind that people can actually like take him as a serious whistleblower. I mean, he's not a whistleblower at all. He's working with the same organizations that we're fighting against, and you know, like let's have a look at the secrets that he's actually exposing. You know, it's things that are deliberately damaging only to the US, not just to the US, I mean, but largely speaking, the big exposés have damaged the US with the help of the international media, and that's exactly what the whole political dynamic is trying to do, which is take down the West and this kind of thing. You know, and the fact that he was actually working with Russia Today, you know, during his stay in the Ecuadorian embassy, supposed stay in the Ecuadorian embassy, you know, says it all, really. You know, Russia Today, who also employ people like Larry King, you know, like Sean Stone, like all these other characters that I've exposed in previous podcasts, that they make up facets of the establishment, and there really is no difference between Russia Today and the Western media, certainly not in their intentions, long scale sort of thing. They are just both vital parts of the Jewish international media establishment, just playing different roles because they're different organizations based in different countries. That's the only difference there is. There's no difference in the ideologies of the people running them. They're purely being used as propaganda, sort of lie machines, deception, disinformation machines. But obviously, because the Western media is so obviously corrupt, just comparing one with another, just comparing Russia Today with Western media makes Russia Today look good. But it doesn't mean that they're not just as corrupt, and it doesn't mean they're not just working to the same objectives. And I think, you know, the increasing popularity of Russia Today has, you know, tells a great story, that they have offices in lots and lots of Western cities these days, and you know, they're not enemies of the West. You know, they got offices in London and stuff. You know, they're not getting closed down. They're not getting shut down because they're, you know, sabotage, you know, they're spy organizations or whatever. No, they're just peddling different propaganda that is complementary to the Western propaganda, because they want people to be drawn into supporting Putin and whatever Russia's trying to do. I mean, the fact that Julian Assange is being employed by the Russian state to produce propaganda is telling in itself, and the kind of people he's meeting up with supposedly meeting up with in the Ecuadorian embassy is quite amazing. So if you if you're interested in looking up these characters that he's meeting up with, then you can just look for The World Tomorrow. The World Tomorrow, which is the name of his TV series, which he's produced for RT. So there you have it. That's another sort of very, very direct connection with the global power elite, which is that he is commissioned to work for the Russian state and produce propaganda for the Russian state under their own state-owned media corporation, Russia Today, or RT, as it's now called. There's other details that I want to go into as well, like all the movies and all the publicity that that has been very, very useful to WikiLeaks in the sort of building up of WikiLeaks as an institution and of Julian Assange as a sort of superhero character in the world. And there was a movie created in 2013 called We Steal Secrets, The Story of WikiLeaks. And guess who was the executive producer of this movie? None other than Jemima Khan, or Jemima Goldsmith, should we say. And Jemima Goldsmith is the daughter of James Goldsmith, who is a billionaire Jewish businessman and is extremely, extremely well close, so well connected to the royal family in the UK and all this kind of thing. And this movie was, of course, extremely you know, useful to WikiLeaks and to the establishment desire to promote WikiLeaks. And one of its producers was in fact a guy called Mark Schmuger, who used to be the chairman of Universal Pictures, believe it or not. So we have, so we have the elite of the elite that are making efforts to promote him, and I suggest that this is why, you know, everyone's heard of him today. Like, you know, I think it's, you know, we should actually ask people, where did you hear of Julian Assange? And they, you know, scratch their head. Well, it would have definitely been on the news or in the newspaper and mainstream newspaper and stuff like this. You know, of course it is. Where else are they going to have heard of him? You know, and most people who absolutely idolise him have never read a single document that he's produced. I've never read the first thing about him. They don't know anything about, you know, what the whole thing's been about. You know, it's pretty amazing, really, that the media can sculpt a character so clearly in the minds of people that they will, you know, completely fall for it and say, yes, Julian Assange is our hero. You know, the and you know, it's absolutely amazing to me. But excuse me. I think another interesting detail is the people who have actually put up bail money for Julian Assange before, because there was you know, that he was arrested, obviously, before he eventually gained sanctuary at the Ecuadorian embassy. And this is all just the official story and stuff, you know, like, so we can, I don't really believe he was ever under arrest. I think he was doing other things. I think likely his 6 or 7 year stay in the Ecuadorian embassy was a fantastic cover narrative for whatever other crimes he was committing, maybe crimes similar to those of Anne Hamilton Byrne, you never know. But I don't for one second believe that he was in that embassy all that time. Not at all. Never. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. But look at the kind of people that that have put up bail money for him. You know, we have a woman called Lady Caroline Evans, or Lady Caroline Michelle, or Mikkel, who was a publisher for Random House and Harper Press. You know, mainstream publishers that have put up thousands and thousands of pounds for his bail money. We have Philip Knightley, who was for 20 years at the Sunday Times and the Mail and the Independent, you know, mainstream media. You know, we have a woman called Tracy Worcester, who is a super elite sort of, they describe her as an environmental activist. And she was actually attended by Charles and Diana at her wedding, believe it or not, which gives you an idea about how well connected she is. And she was putting up bail money for Julian Assange. And we have a guy called Sir John Sulston, who was a biologist, and he won a Nobel Prize for his gene research, and he's also thrown in bail money for Assange. And I think one of the most interesting connections is a guy called Vaughan Smith. Now, Vaughan Smith is the owner of a club called the Frontline Club, which hosts lots of political debates and things like this. And I saw a political debate in which there was Richard Dimbleby, who will be very familiar to people in the UK, I'm sure, who was hosting a debate and things like this. So they have very, very big name people attending the Frontline Club. And Julian Assange himself has done several speeches there. And you can have a look. This club's still going today. And you can have a look at the people that they've hosted and the people that they plan to host. And this Frontline Club is directly funded by, guess what, wait for it, George Soros and his Open Society Foundation. So we have people directly funded by George Soros involved in the protection of Julian Assange. And if I and it was actually this this guy Vaughan Smith who Assange was given refuge at. Assange, after he was arrested, he needed a place to stay, sort of thing. He needed a bail address. And he actually stayed at the Frontline Club in London, which was owned by this Vaughan Smith guy, funded by George Soros. And then he actually lived at Vaughan Smith's private home, believe it or not. So he was actually given his own, you know, he opened his own house to let Assange stay there. You know, it's absolutely amazing. Like, you know, so we have Soros's money directly involved in Assange as well. So, I mean, obviously there's plenty more that can be exposed about Assange. I really think. I hope I've given you lots of threads to follow if you fancy following them and finding out other information, because there's an awful lot of information to delve into, and I really think that Assange is still working for the same people that were or the same organisations, at least, that were responsible for the experiments going on in the family in Australia. I believe he's still very well connected with the CIA, with the Tavistock Institute, and with all these kind of sort of elite international organisations, which is exactly why they have felt so comfortable in projecting this character into the absolute, you know, yeah, in sort of intergalactic superstardom, you know, this Julian Assange character, and yeah, I really think that that this information should be sufficient for people to no longer support him. We can, you know, and it's not to say we don't support transparency. That's not to say we don't support the you know, the disclosing of documents that you know, that prove criminality, especially if the law enforcement organisations, as they rarely do, they don't follow up on elite criminality, and we do need to, you know, make the elite accountable and things like this. I'm just saying that is not what Assange's role is. Assange's role is to, you know, actually to use the following of WikiLeaks to pressurize governments and actually force an agenda onto various institutions or national governments, that is, that is desired by the people Assange is working for, the globalist agenda, basically. And that's what Assange's role is, I think. Another interesting aspect of what WikiLeaks managed to do was in Iceland, when they were responsible for the exposing of banks in Iceland and this kind of thing, and it created a big waves in Iceland, sort of thing, and there were serious, very, very serious political consequences to WikiLeaks' actions in Iceland. And it was actually admitted that between Julian Assange and I think five other people, they actually sat down and wrote Iceland's political sort of declaration, which was then unanimously sort of ratified by the Icelandic government. So, in Iceland, concerning Iceland, they have actually been involved in, but basically amending their constitution almost, writing laws, for a sovereign nation, a supposedly sovereign nation, because this is the influence they have. They are actually extremely, extremely dangerous, and yeah, and especially as people just believe what WikiLeaks are saying because of the way that they have had their the way that they've been presented in the media, basically, people just believe it if it's coming from WikiLeaks, and so I think there's basically too much damning information about WikiLeaks to ignore. I would suggest, like, you're living in a dream world if you think that WikiLeaks is actually there, is there to help us, is there to actually stop any meaningful criminal agenda that the establishment are doing, because it's my strong suggestion to you that it's only because of the establishment that WikiLeaks is where it is today, in absolute superstardom, and with, yeah, an almost sort of untouchable following, sort of thing, and people that will, that have completely got hooked on the concept of WikiLeaks as it's been presented by the mainstream media. So yeah, I've also made some observations about Julian Assange's kind of the way he carries himself, the way he talks, and this kind of thing, and it always seems to me that when he's talking, it looks as though he's got something else on his mind, sort of thing. He's not really quite there. He's not, he talks very much like a politician and things like this, I really think the guy is, if you actually look at him, and he's actually very much sort of creeped people out in the past. Like, for example, the guy that I mentioned in last week's episode, where that was running a audio studio that Assange went to while he was supposedly on house arrest, in order to record his Simpsons episode, which was about him. So yeah, my initial sort of impressions of him from watching him actually talk and act, just really, really, I don't know, just creeps me out. And I think that, he just behaves. He behaves like an intelligence asset, and that, he really doesn't come across as trustworthy in the slightest. But I'd like to also introduce you all now to my wonderful better half, Maria, who has also some comments on Julian Assange and particularly his appearance. So here's Maria.
Hello. Yeah, so I noticed a couple of things about his hair, actually, because I have quite a historic relationship with bleach. I actually started bleaching my hair when I was 14, so I'm now 24, so that relationship has lasted for a decade, and the bleach is only just growing out the ends of my hair. So I'm nearly bleach free, but I spent all those years dealing with bleach, and I can tell from looking at his hair that his style is basically a very hard to achieve sort of style. It's not kind of easily obtained with your own, with your general DIY kit. So I would say that with his hair being so smooth and so impeccably white all the time, that he's certainly got his own hairstylist helping him with that. Now, you might think that he's just a really, really odd guy. And I don't know, is he supposed to have earned money? As the story goes, is he supposed to have earned a lot of money through his WikiLeaks?
Well, I mean, they have been getting large donations, of which they actually, ironically, for WikiLeaks, they keep secret. But WikiLeaks, at least on the face of it, sort of spend a lot less money than they bring in through donations. So yeah, no, he does have money. And I've seen another website which suggests he actually earns $10 million a month. And that wouldn't entirely surprise me. But again, it's very difficult to... I mean, because you'd have thought something like WikiLeaks wouldn't cost that much money to actually run. And if he's achieving, you know, like global donations, you know, to quite large extents, then there's probably a lot of excess money swishing around, I would suggest.
Well, yeah, because I was wondering if he was known as someone who's profited quite a lot from this organisation that he's set up. Because that, because on the topic of his hair, if he was known to have quite a lot of money, then people might think that he's just an odd guy living in exile with his own hairdresser sorting his hair out. But to me, it's kind of more likely that he's just a total fake character who, you know, is helped out by stylists rather than being a genuine guy with a personal hairdresser, because I'm convinced that he's got a personal hairdresser from the look of his hair, personally.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't think there's anything real about his his person, and that includes his name and everything else. And most people aren't aware, because of the way he's been depicted, that he's actually an extremely tall person as well. I mean, this actually came as quite a surprise to me that he was so tall. He's like, I don't know exactly what his height is, but it's at least like 6'6".
Really?
Like, he's extremely tall. Like, but I guess through all the ways he's been filmed and this kind of thing, they kind of haven't, you know, made a... They've sort of filmed him in a way that doesn't make him look sort of freakishly tall.
Yeah, I think he comes across a bit more dweebish. Whether or not you associate that with height, I don't know, but just... it's all about his face and his weird way of speaking and his hair and his creepy conversation. Yeah. Now, I don't find him convincing, and I don't know if you've mentioned that documentary that we watched. Have you?
Which documentary?
We watched it the other night about Julian Assange.
There's a few that... One of them's called Risk, and there's another... There's been quite a few documentaries made about Julian Assange by sort of fairly mainstream media characters.
Well, I didn't find any of the characters in that documentary. So basically all the characters that are supposed... Whether or not you've seen the documentary, it's all the people who are supposed to be Julian Assange's sort of pals and colleagues, and I didn't find any of them to be convincing. I think people are so used to seeing fake actors pretending to be genuine on the news and in documentaries on telly all the time that they don't actually recognise actors when they see them. And I think, you know, you rarely see someone on a mainstream documentary who's actually genuine and isn't totally lying. So I think everyone's gotten used to the lying faces, but to me it just seems completely untrue, everything that they say, and I just don't believe any of them.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, actually, that, you know, our media is controlled to such a degree, and we're being told that this is sort of reality TV, you know, like news is supposed to be reality TV, the original reality TV, telling us what's actually going on with, you know, real witnesses, real people, you know, telling stories and things like this. But because it's been, you know, a work of pure fiction for so long, that people actually can't recognise truth from fiction these days, and they can't recognise acting from people expressing genuine emotion, genuine opinions, and this kind of thing, because they don't know what it looks like on a telly, because we just never see it. And I think this is why they like to use actors and things in every single event that they can, so that they, you know, because if suddenly there was a terrorist attack and there was a character showing genuine emotion on the telly, that would stand out an absolute mile, and it would make people realise, hey, wait a second, this is how a normal person reacts. Yeah. Like, so, yeah, they can't really allow that to happen, so, and they have to control sort of every, you know, everything that they put out there. But yeah, I mean, maybe we can talk a bit about the Notre Dame thing, because that's obviously the other big topical story at the moment as well, and I think the evidence is mounting up to suggest that this was actually a deliberate fire created by people within the establishment, and I think a big piece of evidence for that is that within maybe an hour, I'm not sure exactly, but in a very, very short space of time since the fire sort of erupted, the media and the authorities were saying, no, nothing to worry about, it's definitely not arson. And if that isn't a massive indication that it's definitely arson, then I don't know what it is.
Yeah, how could you know that quickly?
Yeah, and why would you be prepared to rule that out immediately? If it's a genuine, if these people are genuinely interested in finding out the truth, and there was an analogy made with 9/11 that, you know, within hours of the 9/11 attacks, and, you know, before obviously Building 7 had even fallen, they were already blaming Bin Laden for the 9/11 attacks, and I suggest that this lie that the fire was some kind of accident is just as obvious. And in fact, they, because they like to state these things straight away, it really, you know, gives their game away, and you know, it's actually great for us that they do expose themselves so quickly after these events and give us a huge clue. I mean, I saw a bit of footage, I don't know if you saw it, of a guy walking across the top of Notre Dame, and there was a big spark, a big like flash of light that came just before the fire started.
What?
Yeah, it was like caught on CCTV. It was on YouTube. Whether it still is or not, I don't know.
What you mean? Just as the fire was about to
just before the
beginning, or
yeah, I think it was caught. It was like a kind of a grainy black and white image, but you could clearly see a person moving across the top of the Notre Dame, and then this big flash of light coming from up there, and then the fire started shortly afterwards. And apparently, this piece of it was just captured by a nearby CCTV camera or nearby private security camera or something.
Right.
But yeah, obviously the authorities won't be interested in that because it doesn't fit their first hour speculation that it was not a yeah, not a a deliberate fire. But I think one thing that the that they've been doing, I think, as the sort of stage two in this sort of psychological operation, which is obviously, you know, the devastation of the Notre Dame and the huge upset that it's caused for the French people, the indigenous French people, that is. Now there's the second stage, which seems to me to be this manufactured outrage at this outpouring of money.
Yeah, I saw something saying, you know, if only people cared about Notre Dame as much as they cared about Grenfell Tower, which is quite funny because, I mean, I think people cared quite a lot about Grenfell Tower. I mean, a lot. I think it was probably the biggest story of that year. Well, actually, it was the same year as all the Manchester bombings and everything, wasn't it? So, you know, it was one of the biggest stories of that year. I mean, the amount of attention put towards that was absolutely humongous. So people can hardly pretend that, you know, people just turn their cheek to Grenfell Tower and that everyone cares about Notre Dame. And also, you know, people are hardly going to be pouring billions into restoring the former glory of Grenfell Tower. It's not exactly an icon of English culture as Notre Dame is to France. So very, very different. The only similarity is the flames, really.
Yeah.
So it's a really ludicrous comparison to make and just, you know, aim to draw more attention towards the immigrants and the poor people of the poor victims of Grenfell and away from the kind of European culture that's being destroyed simultaneously, which is kind of symbolised through the burning of Notre Dame.
Yeah, I mean, the Grenfell Tower story was such big news that we were absolutely sick of it by the time a couple of months had gone, and it was in the media absolutely constantly. And then another few months after that, we're being told that no one cared about it, and it was just, what, you know, brushed under the carpet, which is, you know, unless people have absolutely no memory of what it was like in the aftermath of Grenfell Tower, then they should know that this is absolute nonsense. But I saw memes going around sort of comparing the, you know, 700 million euros or 1 billion euros or whatever that was raised for Notre Dame and compare that to the, I think it said 28 million pounds raised for Grenfell or whatever. But at the end of the day, what do the Grenfell survivors need with 1 billion euros? Well, how is making the victims absolutely stinking rich a priority? I would suggest it isn't, and I would suggest that the sort of community support that those people received after Grenfell Tower was pretty much unique in the world, in the sense that there were hundreds of people donating a large amount of their time. There were like trucks and trucks full of clothes and food and all sorts of resources for these people, so much so that within a few days they were turning people away and saying, do not bring any more clothes. I mean, I went down there myself, as did Maria, and we saw that there were, you know, piles and piles of clothes left on the side of the street because, you know, there's only so many clothes that 150 people can wear, or however many people there were that survived the tower fire can wear, you know.
Quite disproportionate, actually, the level of generosity for what was actually needed, and the amount of time that everyone dedicated to that, you know, coming, volunteering, cooking, all of that time people put in. I don't know what's happening around Notre Dame, but it's not really the same sort of, I don't imagine it's the same kind of community effort, because it's not that people have lost their homes in this case.
Yeah, that's it, you know. And it's any excuse to try and, like, make out that people are somehow evil. Whereas, you know, the fact is that all this money, this, you know, obscene amount of money that has been collected or offered for the reparation of Notre Dame, it's been sent largely by a handful of families and major corporations, none of which have the interests of any normal person at heart. And one of these families is an openly Jewish family, which within a few hours of the burning of this Christian cathedral was willing to choke up 200 million euros to its restoration. And then Emmanuel Macron has said that the new Notre Dame will be better than the old one, suggesting that they're not just going to restore it, they're going to change it. And maybe this is part of the reason why all these extremely wealthy, elite, sort of Judeo-Masonic families are happy to, you know, to offer such huge amounts of money, because it will be a kind of a, you know, a very symbolic sort of reference to the ongoing collapse of France that they are engaged in.
And how could you make it better, really? I mean, it's a beautiful building. I mean, I wonder what they're planning with their improvement of it, you know. Is it going to be some kind of Muslim twist to it or something?
Well, you don't know, yeah, exactly, you know. Yeah, shudder to think, really. So, yeah, I think we're nearly out of time. Is there anything else you want to say, Maria, on your first appearance on my show?
Oh, not really. I don't know, I'm busy looking after the baby these days. I'd really recommend having a baby to any youngsters out there. It's really great. Yeah, no, that's it, really. I'm all baby at the moment. Yeah, really enjoying that. Could maybe talk a bit more about that at some point. I don't know how many kind of young women there are in this movement, but if there are, then I'd really recommend getting yourself a nice bloke and having a lovely little baby. And that's it.
We really need it. Yeah. Yeah, we really need it. And I'm of course, absolutely loving it as well. And trying to find time for my research and making these radio shows and my podcast at the same time, and as well as trying to develop some skills that will be useful in our lives and things. But yeah, it's the most wonderful thing, and you know, it's the one thing that we're discouraged from doing, you know, and it's that same one thing that is the greatest cause of happiness that we can have is mm-hmm. bringing another life into the world and to actually, you know, give it the best possible chance at a happy life and to have, you know, good values and to enrich the world and enrich our people. So yeah, I would echo Maria's sentiments, and yeah, that's something we desperately need as white Christian Europeans. But I think that's about time up for today. And thank you very much, Maria, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And and I'll speak to you, good folk, at Eurofolk Radio again soon. And just like to take the last moments to thank Paul English again for his ongoing support and helping me set up this radio show, and thanks to Briser and Graham Hart at Grism as well for their ongoing support. You can find my work on podcast.com. If you search for my name, Alan Buttle, it'll come up there, and you can download any of the previous episodes for free. There's no paywall behind any of my work. You can download it and listen to it at your leisure, and this is just my attempt to help out with our cause, which is the survival of our people and the freeing of our world from Jewish enslavement, basically. So yeah, have a wonderful weekend. I hope you had a good Friday. Hope you have a good Saturday, and I'll see you next time. Happy Easter, and bye bye for now.